Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well. What tips do they have for you and I? And I quiz them about how they apply their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. For today's episode, I'm joined by Dr. Susie Green, clinical and coaching psychologist and founder of the Positivity Institute. Susie is one of the most enthusiastic and energetic people I have ever met. She is prolific in her work as a positive psychologist. She never seems to stay still in one spot, traveling the countryside and the world, speaking, consulting, and working with clients. When she's not working, she's passionately engaged in living life to its fullest at home in Sydney. Susie was one of my lecturers when I was undertaking my postgraduate studies in coaching psychology at the University of Sydney, and I'm very privileged to work with her as a senior associate at the Positivity Institute. It's fabulous to have you here, Susie. Welcome.
Hi, Ellen. Thank you so much for such a wonderful introduction, and it's really great to be here speaking with you today.
I'm excited to have you here. I've got lots of questions I want to ask you, and I know you've got a lot of great insights and wisdom to share with our audience about living life to its fullest, both from your academic expertise and expertise in working with clients, but also just from the way you actually live life itself. So before I really get into the nitty-gritty of the work that you do, I'd love it, Susie, if you could please just explain for our listeners what positive psychology is.
Okay, well, I guess very simply, it's the science of well-being, but probably even more broadly, it's the science of optimal human functioning. So really us at our best, if you like.
Yep. And a big part of that, I mean, that encompasses a huge amount. And I know from my work that positive psychology has been a rapidly growing field with lots of really interesting research done in lots of different domains. And one of the things that I know you're interested in, and I am as well, is the idea of strengths.
Yeah, definitely.
Can you tell us a bit about what strengths are from a psychological point of view?
It really is, I guess, foundational, as you know, Ellen, to positive psychology. And it was one of the first, I guess, projects that Professor Marty Seligman and Nihal Yeczykcsikszentmihalyi, the founding fathers of positive psych, undertook a project to look at, in particular, what's known as character strengths. So when we are talking about strengths, I like to differentiate them from the character strengths, which I just referred to before, but also performance strengths, which some of your listeners might know in terms of Gallup, who've had Strengths Finder, and they've done a lot of research on strengths in the workplace over many years. And the other tool and the model that we like is Strengths Profiler out of the UK. They're both really useful, but I find personally, we like to use the VIA character strengths as a really nice introduction and I guess a foundation, because they're morally valued. They're actually defined as morally valued character strengths, and there's 24 of them. And I usually say, you know, by the time I leave the planet, I hope I've developed the full 24. I'm not there yet. but whereas the performance strengths, you know, there's, I think, a 60 on Strengths Profiler, and it may not be necessary that we need to develop all of those strengths. And they're probably more relevant in the workplace. I've used them extensively in career coaching, and they also particularly assess for energy. So it's a really nice insight for people to think about, are they using these performance strengths at work? In some cases, they're actually overusing them, which can lead to a lack of energy or a drop in energy. But the research is certainly supporting that if you can use these strengths, you're actually going to be more energized. And that's, I guess, what we're all looking for.
Yeah, absolutely. And can you give us an example of a performance strength? We'll start with that and then we'll move on to the character strengths. What's the kind of performance strength that somebody at work might possess and use in order to give them that energy?
Yeah, there's a few I can think of. The two that immediately come to mind for me are two of my own, which were really sort of quite powerful when I received my strength survey back, which is mission and legacy. And at the time when I did this, was probably over 10 years ago, I was really starting to see just how meaningful, particularly the work that I do in education. And I think the other, I guess, big aha for me was, particularly in those performance strengths, it actually, Strengths Profiler has a weakness component. It's the only strengths assessment tool that actually does have a weakness. And mine was actually courage at the time. And similarly on the VIA, bravery was in my bottom five. So, you know, it's something that I feel, you know, being challenged by most of my life is pushing myself out of my comfort zone. So I'm not a natural, you know, adventure is another one of these performance strengths. I'm not a natural push myself out of my comfort zone. I'm not a spotlight. Spotlight's another performance strength which you need to have if you are out there presenting. And of course, my work was increasingly leading to more presentation. And so once I sort of had this insight that I had mission and legacy, I also had optimism, drive and growth as realized strengths, it was a turning point for me when I realized that I could actually use those strengths for my presentations, which then took the tension or the stress around, you know, performing, if you like, and it became much more aligned to these strengths of growth and optimism and mission and legacy, and it had had a powerful impact on my life. Just while I think about it, another client example I can give you is a client that was referred to me for executive coaching because her boss wanted her to take another a new position. And she'd sort of said to me, oh, he only wants that because it suits him. You know, it's not really something that I want to do. And so we had a coaching session using the strengths profile, and it became really clear to her that one of her unrealized strengths, so in this case, these performance strengths are the things that you've said you're good at and you're energized by, but there's one component called unrealized strengths. So these are things that you've said you're good at, you're energized by, but you're not actually using. And she had strategic awareness. So this is this capacity to really think strategically, big picture. And what her boss was seeing in her was this strength, but she hadn't actually fully owned it in herself. And when she realized that this new role would give her so much opportunity to use that strength and also wind back some of her learned behaviors, so some of the strengths that she was doing a lot of at the moment, she actually then decided she was going to take the job, you know, for herself rather than just for her boss.
Yeah. So is this the, in, for you, I suppose, in working, particularly in this case, you know, with performance strengths, we're talking often about working in workplaces and organizations. Is it using a tool, and these are tools, questionnaires that people can complete? Is it getting that insight, I suppose, or perhaps reinforcing some of the things that somebody might know about themselves, but also revealing things that, as you say, other people might see in you that you don't see in yourself? Is this the power of this kind of knowledge and information for people?
I think so. And because I've used it extensively in so many different audiences over the years, and particularly, as you know, Ellen, in Australia, in our culture, we have tended to be more modest. I think that's changing with our younger generation, which is probably good that the younger generation are more confident in speaking up around their strengths. So for many people, it actually does, you know, give them a language and a vocabulary and some insight into strengths that perhaps they hadn't fully owned before. And for others, yeah, they really have what we would call, I guess, in coaching, blind spots, if you like. And so other people are seeing it, but they're not seeing it in themselves. So I've actually seen one workshop I was running. There were four ladies that worked together in a library at a university. And when they were sharing their results, and I went around and I asked one of the ladies, you know, how did you go? And she said, oh, I don't think this is right. And I said, well, you know, it's a self-report. You did fill it in. And then immediately after that, the other three ladies gave the most genuine examples, very different examples of how they had seen that strength in this other lady they were working with. And you could actually see in real time her body language changing, you know, sort of quiet, oh, really? You know, and then by the end of the workshop, she was holding herself up, she was owning these strengths. And so it's really, it can be really powerful for people when they start to see themselves quite differently, if you like.
Yeah, incredibly, especially in that scenario where you've actually had the opportunity for colleagues and people who work with you to reinforce this piece of information, this knowledge that perhaps you haven't seen.
Yes. And I guess another exercise we do that's every single time I do it, I've done it hundreds of times now, I still get goosebumps with. We do a strength spotting exercise primarily with the character strengths. So we have some VIA character strengths cards at the Positivity Institute. So I usually lay a whole stack of them down on the floor, and then I'll ask, you know, the people in the workshop, and ideally you want people that know each other, and you, the instructions are to give a card away to some one of your colleagues, and don't just sort of go, oh, here you go, Ellen, I'll give you, you know, kindness, because you're always looking to help. You really want to be specific in examples of where you've seen those strengths. And every time I run this, there are like, I get goosebumps. People, sometimes people are crying, hugging. And, you know, we did this with a very large leadership group a couple of years ago, and it was nearly all men, actually, there's 70. And one man at the end of it, when I asked for feedback, he stood up and he said, we never do this. We never give this sort of feedback to each other. And how good is it to do this, you know? So I love the strengths. Obviously, positive psychology has a lot, you know, more other interventions and strategies. But for me, it is one of the foundational pieces and key pieces.
Yeah. And so that's performance strengths. And you mentioned there the VIA, which is the Seligman's, or started out as Seligman's, yeah, character strengths.
That's
so
it.
What is the difference? What's the primary difference in your mind between, say, performance strengths and these character strengths?
Yeah, I think as before, the character strengths is 24. The research was done cross-culturally, so it doesn't matter what culture you go into, what religious affiliation. We work with different schools with different religious affiliations. Because it was done cross-culturally, they looked historically through philosophy, so you can use them because they're applicable in every context pretty much. Now, for example, kindness or love or leadership or fairness, whereas the performance strengths, as I said, they may not all be relevant to you. And I guess one of the key questions that suggested that you ask is when you look at your current job and then, you know, you look at the strengths that you have or perhaps the weaknesses. So perhaps you're thinking, oh, I don't really have a strength that's needed in, you know, potentially needed. I guess the key question is it job critical? How critical is it that you have that strength in the role that you're in? And if you don't, the options are you can work on developing it. So, you know, I've worked with clients before that have actually said, actually, I think I wouldn't mind developing that strength. And there's an intrinsic motivation to do so. The other option is to work with another person in your team through complementary role partnering, we call it, finding someone else in the team that is your go-to person if you need to, you know, you need a bit of optimism or you need a strategic awareness, like I mentioned before. And the other option, which is, I guess, the example I also shared before, is when you look to your other strengths, your realized strengths or unrealized strengths, and you think about how you're going to use those to compensate, if you like, in areas of your role where you don't have a natural strength.
Mm-hmm. And what about outside of the workplace? Because these strengths have an application, I mean, very much when we talk about work and our careers, but yeah, they also have an application outside of work, don't they?
They certainly do. And I think, you know, sometimes we find people are using strengths outside of work and they will say, yeah, yeah, definitely, I use it outside of work, but they've never thought about using it in the work setting as well, or vice versa. But I think for me, it's probably more the character strengths, because they basically, at their very core, it's about being a good human being. That's what those character strengths are about. And as I said before, we don't, and particularly when you're taking this into schools with children, you don't want them to just know their top five. You actually want to introduce the full 24, develop a vocabulary, a language, and have strategies and interventions to develop the full 24 over time.
And where can people find out their strengths? Because the VIA survey is very accessible to people, is it not?
There's actually a free version, and I've just heard there's, I don't know, 7 or 8 million more people have done it worldwide now. So I think it's just the viainstitute.org, I think it is. So yeah, there's a free version. There's also a paid version around, I think, $20. And I would advise if you are able to do that, because the report's quite good actually that you get with the paid version, and you get suggestions on how to develop perhaps lesser strengths. We don't necessarily call them weaknesses in character strengths, but they may be lesser strengths, if you like, or middle level strengths.
Mm-hmm. And I will put a link to the character strengths survey in the show notes for this episode. Susie, what are your top strengths?
Zest is my top strength.
I have to tell you. This doesn't surprise me, knowing you.
Not all the time. And funnily enough, I am a big fan of the nap. So if I get an opportunity to have a 15-minute nap, I've mastered the nap over years. And my team find it really amazing that I can just lie down, pretty much fall asleep within a couple of minutes and be up again in 15 minutes. So if I have an evening event, I definitely need a nap. I'm a morning person, so 5 a.m. starts for me during the week. I usually have a bit of a sleep in on the weekend. But I also realized very early on in my career that to be able to help other people, I had to really invest heavily in my own well-being. So I do make a commitment to my zest and energy and vitality, if you like. But I think I'm probably one of those people that was blessed with it genetically as well. So I'm very grateful for that. The other two strengths I've got that work often hand in hand, actually three of them, are curiosity, love of learning, and creativity. Mm-hmm. So I'm very curious. And again, I have to really watch I don't overplay these strengths. So because it can lead to one of my business coaches said I was suffering from SOS, shiny object syndrome. Because you see so many opportunities, and I know, Ellen, you're the same, so many applications. So we often talk about, when it comes to strengths, winding them up and winding them down, you know, and in what situations do you need to wind up or wind down? So I know with zest and curiosity are the ones I've really got to watch that I don't overplay. And then hope is my fifth one. So, and I often say, how on earth could I do what I'm doing as a coach and someone that has a mission to increase worldwide well-being if I wasn't high on hope? You know, there'd be no point.
Yes. So yeah. It plays into what you do in how you do it, so how you live your life, that zest and that energy. But, yeah, hope in terms of, and it's interesting then that ties in, you're talking about the performance strengths of legacy, and I can see how, in terms of building the Positivity Institute and the work that you do, which is very future focused, yes, and is really around helping our community to thrive and flourish. And we'll talk a bit more about that in a moment. How all of those strengths come into play there.
Definitely.
Okay. Speaking of the Positivity Institute and how it came to be, I love the story of how you, because you started as a clinical psychologist working in quite clinical fields. And you had your own transformation maybe to move away or away from that and into positive psychology and coaching in these new fields. And you have a wonderful video that I will put in the show notes that was part of the launch, I think, of the Positivity Institute that tells this story. But can you share it with our listeners? How did you come to be where you are today?
Yeah, I guess it is a bit of a long journey. So I'll give you the shortened version. I actually did leave school when I was 16. No one in my family had ever gone to university. There was no expectations. I have a beautiful family, beautiful parents, but it was really just at that time you were married and you had children. So I did leave school when I was 16 and I did secretarial studies, and I was a damn good secretary, let me tell you. And those skills have paid off big time. You know, and I could still pull out a little bit of shorthand here and there when I need to. But I was actually encouraged by someone to go to university in my mid-20s. And to my surprise, I actually, in those days you could sit a test, and I actually got in, to my surprise. And my partner at the time was actually studying psychiatry. He was doing medicine and looking to do psychiatry. And so I was quite intrigued by the stories that he was telling. And he said, why don't you think about studying psychology? So I enrolled in uni and I enrolled in psychology. I also enrolled in other subjects, I think English lit and philosophy and organisational behaviour. But I still to this day remember my very first lecture in psychology. And there's probably about 120 at that time in the class. And I had no confidence, had no idea. Well, I was thinking, what am I doing here, you know? And the lecturer said, sort of painted a picture of the journey that we might be on over the, you know, next 10 so years. And he basically said, there's probably only going to be maybe 10 to 12 of you that make it through to the very end. And something went click in my head. And honestly, I had no reason to believe that it would be me, but I knew it was going to be me. and it's just really funny because I really clearly, it was one of those defining moments. And, you know, I did all right in the other subjects, credits, passes, but I just excelled in psychology. And I obviously had my partner who was doing psychiatry, so I have a huge sense of gratitude to him for cultivating my thinking around the area. And so my first job was actually in a psychiatric clinic. So I was thrown in the deep end with people that were very, very psychiatrically unwell. I'm actually grateful for that too, because I worked out pretty quickly that I didn't think I could personally do that sort of work all day. But I also, my kids were in primary school and I started to think, this is nuts. Like, why aren't my kids learning the skills that I'm starting to learn, particularly as a clinical psychologist? And I thought, these are life skills. You know, why do we wait until people are unwell to give them? So that has taken me on this incredible journey where I managed to, you know, do a welfare study on coaching as a mental health prevention and promotion and activity. And at that time, positive psychology was emerging. So I was really in the right place at the right time. So timing is everything, I always think. So again, I feel very, very blessed to have been in the right place at the right time and have been involved in seeing this field emerging in Australia and globally.
And that is one of the aims of positive psychology, isn't it? Because it's one of the things I'm passionate about as well, that we can share this knowledge, this expertise, these skills that have been researched and that we're starting to build up as a body of work, and the application of that is starting to kind of play out across various different domains right now, and use that as much for the prevention, hopefully, of mental health issues, not necessarily perhaps some of those, you know, really biologically based psychiatric issues, but certainly our mild to moderate experience of anxiety, depression as a preventative, and then also to give people the tools to really live at life's fullest.
Exactly. And we really do, as you know, have quite a lot of research now to, I guess, prescribe, if you like, what are some of the strategies that have been proven to significantly improve psychological well-being over time. But I still think, you know, one of the first jobs I had out of uni was working in a dietitian's office. And I had client after client coming along to me saying, I could be a dietitian. I know what I'm meant to be doing. I'm just not doing it. So I think we still have the same challenges in terms of where, you know, we can prescribe these activities, but the doing is the challenge. And that's where I know you and I agree, Ellen, based on our backgrounds, that coaching psychology as a complementary field has a lot to offer in terms of actually taking that knowledge and putting it into practice.
Yes, the application of positive psychology.
That's it.
Fabulous. And so the Positivity Institute started when? I can't remember exactly.
2012. So it's, six years this year. Yeah.
And what's the mission of the Positivity Institute?
I guess pretty simply, it's to increase worldwide well-being. And I usually say it may not happen in my lifetime. I know Seligman's got a similar goal to significantly improve, 51% of the population by 2051 or something like that, to have them flourishing. So that's our mission. It is an aspirational, I guess, mission. And we do that through three arms of the business, which is through life. So that's offering some individual services, and then through schools, and then through the workplace.
And the schools piece. So you've been very heavily involved in positive education, which is the application of positive psychology in the education sector. Can you tell me a bit about the sorts of programs that you might run in a school, or and some of your colleagues run in a school?
Yeah, definitely. I have been very fortunate again to have been there pretty much from the beginning. So I was involved in this with the second school after Geelong Grammar that implemented, and we've worked with numerous schools, you know, since that time. We still do one-off keynotes and workshops, but our preference really is to work with a school collaboratively over a period of time to get a cultural change happening. And I think, you know, I attended a presentation this week on positive education, and I still think we've got a bit of a way to go in terms of getting clarity around what we're actually trying to do. Because you have got multidiscipline, approaches, so you've got a lot of educators in this space that see the need for it to be combined with the science of pedagogy, if you like, which is not my background, but we're really trying to take more, I guess, of an organisational development, cultural change process. And I think that's been a missing piece too, where schools or positive education haven't looked at it using some of those, you know, a lot of the knowledge that we have that's been used in organisations for cultural change. So we, as I said, much prefer to work with a school over a period of time. The three core components are training. So because people don't know what they don't know, we work primarily with staff, not directly with the students. So we train the staff in the science of positive psychology, and then we offer some coaching to the senior leaders to help them, I guess, act as the levers to really embed it through the culture. But we also consult slash collaborate, I guess, with the director of wellbeing and the wellbeing team to determine what's working well already. So we'd usually start with an audit and map out all the good things that are happening in schools that fall under the umbrella of positive ed. Often, though, I call it, it's a bit of a hodgepodge approach. So you've got all these different bits and pieces and they bring in different speakers here and there. So we try and use a framework to hang everything under, if you like, so everybody can see how everything's connected. And then we also look for gaps and, you know, do we need to create a specific curriculum, or do we need to review and update that? Do we need to look at embedding it into the other types of curriculum? But also looking at, you know, the policies, the procedures, the timetable. So, and as you can see, and I know you've done a lot of work in organisations, that is not short term.
No.
And in fact, we've got a bit of a checklist, and I'm very happy if any of your listeners want to email info@thepositivityinstitute.com. We've got a free checklist where it's a work in progress, but it does give you a sense of all of the different components that we believe are probably fairly integral to a strategic and sustainable positive education program. And when we send that out, when a school contacts us, often the first response is overwhelm, like, oh my goodness, we didn't realize that there's so much here. For example, Perth College, this is our fourth year working with Perth College, and we're really getting some great results now. And they're using measures, they're using the AWR schools, mm-hmm. Dr. Aaron Jardine's involved in that. And they've also used the Gallup measure, engagement measure for their junior school, I believe, too. And so they actually have some results to show that, you know, this investment is paying off, which is really important.
Yeah. And that leads me to my next question, which is, what is the impact? If there's parents listening, and I think I do have a number of parents listening, and I'm a parent myself, and they know that a school that perhaps they're looking at for their child implements positive psychology, positive education as an approach, what is the impact for students?
I guess at the moment, these sort of whole school approaches, they are very hard to evaluate, much like any large organisational, I guess, approach, because there's so many pieces to the pie. You know, one thing I would recommend is that in addition, a lot of schools are picking up these wellbeing measures of staff and students. We usually recommend a culture or a climate survey, which a lot of schools have never used before, but a very commonplace in organisations. We recommend the Voice Climate Inventory. They've actually done some benchmarking in education. It's an Australian survey as well, so you can sort of see the impact on the culture as well as specific wellbeing. We have a lot of research on discrete interventions like gratitude, self-compassion, strengths interventions. So there's a lot of research there on those discrete interventions, but we are yet to get a lot of research, as I said, on these whole school approaches. And I know there are a number of schools that have engaged universities to help them there, but there's not much published at this stage, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
I was just talking actually to a little primary school here in Sydney who contacted me to help them with their journey. And when the principal told me what they'd done, I was blown away. There's already so many fantastic things going there. And he said, you know, like the year one kids understand what a growth mindset is, a fixed mindset. They've done character strengths so they can talk about their strengths. So, you know, they know what automatic negative thoughts are. And this is the schools that we work in. The kids have this language. It's absolutely amazing. And a lot of the staff will actually say you're at a school like Perth College, where they start from it's a K to 12 school, they'll often have a new intake, you know, in year seven. And the staff have actually commented to me that it's visibly obvious that the girls coming in that haven't been to a school that has had either a SEL, a social emotional learning program, or some other form of positive education, they don't have the skills. They're not equipped, particularly around their, I guess, managing their emotions and having these challenging conversations with other kids too.
Yeah, and I suppose that was what I was going to ask, was in terms of, whilst the research might not be there really to fully support these programs, the hopes and aims of them, the goal is really to be able to provide kids with that greater level of social and emotional awareness and the skills to be able to regulate their emotions, to interact well with other kids, really give them what we were saying before, the skills to be, you know, thriving, flourishing people as they get older.
Exactly. And I have had, in presentations, challenges around, well, you know, we don't have sufficient research. And my response to that usually, Ellen, is when you've sat with hundreds of people, as I have over the years, and I know you have too, but specifically when I worked in that very, you know, psychiatrically unwell population, I firmly believe, well, I know that we can teach these skills. We've been doing that. It's been our bread and butter as psychologists for years and years and years. And I believe that we should. We have a duty of care. We may not prevent every episode of mental illness, as you said before, but to not teach these skills to me seems, I think we have a duty of care to do so.
It comes back to that moral piece that we talked about earlier in relation to the character strengths. Yeah, a moral responsibility to share the knowledge. And that's very much my aim here in interviewing yourself and many of our other wonderful colleagues on the podcast, is to be able to create another forum for sharing this kind of knowledge, information, these skills and the expertise that's built up within the profession that doesn't necessarily perhaps always get out there into the public domain as quickly or as easily as we'd like it to.
That's right.
One final question for you, Susie. What would be your top three tips for thriving and flourishing for our audience? What are three simple things they can do?
Well, there's two that I have been asked this question before. Like if you're going to just, I think it was Michael Carr-Gregg asked me this on a radio interview once too. It is tricky, but definitely mindfulness, which is increasingly being referred to as the foundation of flourishing. And for those that are listening that might be new to it, there are various ways that you can engage in it, but there's some fantastic apps that are out there now. The one that really for me has helped to make it a habit has been an Australian one called One Giant Mind, Number One Giant Mind. So we also recommend Smiling Mind. Headspace is fantastic as well. But the thing with the One Giant Mind is it has, I think, a 10-day and then a 30-day. And for me, I had been probably 15 years stopping and starting. It just wasn't becoming habitual. And when I started this probably a couple of years ago now, they suggested do the 30 days and do it consecutively. Try not to have a break at all, and you'll see at about day 25, you'll notice the difference. And I really noticed it. It really made a difference. And since then, I can't imagine a day without doing, and I don't do a long, mindfulness meditation, 10 minutes usually in the morning, but it's the start to my day. So definitely some form of mindfulness or other meditative practice, and there are lots of different ones. The other one's gratitude. So I started a gratitude journal, really showing my age here, in 1997, which was the year before positive psychology formally launched, and I was watching an Oprah program and gratitude came up, and it changed my life at the time. And I still have, last year was my 20th year of journal keeping, and in the early days it was very focused on gratitude. And at that point in time, I probably was taking quite a few things for granted, and it significantly changed my life to realizing just how fortunate I was. And in our workshops, you see people, again, in real time, when you're talking about gratitude, having ahas that they have been, you know, just taking either family members, friends, or just their living in Australia, for example, for granted. So that's the big one. And then I guess the third one, coming back to that whole positive energy piece. So definitely just in those basics, those foundations of making sure you get 8 hours sleep, that you're exercising at least 3 times a week, if not more. We actually, one of our workshop participants, and I can't remember who it was, coined the acronym MEDS, M-E-D-S, are you taking your meds? So M is meditation, E is exercise, D is diet, so mood food, are you eating food that is good for your mood, and S is sleep, so are you getting enough sleep?
I love that. I love that. I might steal that as well. You have to find out who it's from so I can
reference that.
Yes. Thank you so much, Susie, for everything you've shared today. And I do love those top tips at the end. And I know that I can our listeners out there that this is lived and breathed by Susie, and you can see it in her face as you interact with her and in everything that she does. So really do appreciate your time. I will put all of the links both to the Positivity Institute and the work that you do, but also the other references that you've made in our show notes. And listeners will be able to download, we'll put together those three top tips from Susie as well, so you can download that as a PDF and to go forth and thrive and flourish.
Thank you so much, Ellen. You're doing a fantastic job in helping get some of this information out to people and creating a flourishing world. So thank you.
That's part of the aim. Thank you very much, Susie. Thank you so much for joining me for this episode. I told you Susie was enthusiastic, didn't I? She has so many great stories about putting positive psychology to work and how simple activities can really help people to see themselves and the world in a far more optimistic and confidence-boosting light. I hope you are inspired to take steps to uncover and use your strengths to flourish in your life. You'll find a link to the strength survey that Susie mentioned in the show notes. They're all at potential.com.au/podcast, along with a link to Susie's organisation, the Positivity Institute, her social media links, her top tips for uncovering your strengths and optimising your performance, and a transcript of the full interview. Thank you so much too if you are one of the lovely listeners who has taken the time to rate and review the Potential Psychology podcast in iTunes. This helps to spread the word about the great guests I'm chatting to, and it gives more people the opportunity to learn, flourish, and fulfil their potential. If you haven't already, you might also like to join the Potential Psychology community by signing up to my regular newsletter at potential.com.au/subscribe. This will keep you up to date with the latest podcast episodes and blog posts, link you up to top articles in positive psychology, performance and wellbeing, and give you the behind the scenes here at Potential Psychology HQ. I have a very exciting episode coming up next week. I'm talking to Dr. Sarah Mackay, Oxford-educated neuroscientist and professional nap taker, about her brand new book, The Women's Brain Book, The Neuroscience of Health, Hormones and Happiness. Sarah and I chat about the role that hormones play in all stages of a woman's life. She busts some myths about baby brain and brain fade in menopause, and she shares the most intriguing discovery she made while undertaking her research.
It turned out it was very, very hard to find any consensus on PMS. I managed to narrow down the percentage of women who experience PMS symptoms somewhere between 5 and 95%, depending on which country you were looking at.
I hope you can join me for that interview, and have a great week.